Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. In a two-part program in honor of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which begins tomorrow evening at sundown, we'll hear a talk by two Holocaust survivors, both from Hungary, Agnes Schwartz and Magda Brown, both members of the Speakers Bureau of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. The conclusion will be heard next Monday, October 17th at 12 noon. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 29, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Institute for Holocaust Education, the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education.
I have known Agnes Schwartz and Magda Brown for several years now, and they never cease to amaze and inspire me. These two women, each in her own way, exude a strength and perseverance that most of us, thankfully, will never be called upon to demonstrate. While the Holocaust is sometimes thought of as one large history, it's actually comprised of millions of individual experiences. Those of the 9 million Jews living in Europe prior to World War II, those of the millions of other individuals targeted by the Nazis for being disabled, Roma, Slavic, communist, Jehovah's Witnesses, or gay. The complex history of the Holocaust also includes the experiences of perpetrators, of bystanders, and of an unfortunately too few rescuers. Tonight, you will hear about the experiences of Agnes and Magda, two women who not only survived the Nazi onslaught, but have since dedicated their time and energies to sharing their stories and teaching all of us that when prejudice and discrimination go unchallenged, all of humanity is diminished. A note on the format for this evening. Agnes is going to speak first, and then Magda, and then we'll open it up to questions for both of the speakers. One last thing before we begin. In addition to our two speakers, we have quite a number of Holocaust survivors that have joined us this evening, and I'd like to ask all of those individuals in the audience to please stand and be recognized. So if all the Holocaust survivors would stand for just a moment. We also have with us at least one World War II liberator, and so I'd like to ask Roy and any other retired or active military that are with us to please stand and be recognized as well. And with that, I would like to invite Agnes up to take the podium.
Thank you very much, Liz, and thank you so much for the Institute for Holocaust Education in Omaha. I can, as a survivor, I so appreciate their dedication to teach the Holocaust, because as time goes by, there are less and less survivors alive. And when I speak to children, I usually tell them that you're probably the last generation to hear a survivor. And a story is worth 1,000 words. Until you talk to a survivor, I don't think you appreciate truly what happened. Magda and I come from the same country, different cities. Our stories are like night and day. You would not believe that we were from the same place at the same time. I was born in 1933, the year Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. I was born to relatively well-to-do parents who wanted a child for many years and were very happy to get a little girl. And I had set up grandparents on my mother's side. I was the only grandchild in Europe. And I had my mother had an older sister married. But childless, I was her baby too. She was a wonderful seamstress, and she made all my clothes, and I had the most beautiful clothes in the world. Anyhow, I'm just telling you a little bit about my early childhood, because then you have the values of comparing it to what happened later. My mother was a working lady. My father and she operated a business where they sold yard goods to tailors who made custom-made suits. Because of that, we had a live-in housekeeper. Her name was Julia. She was another mom to me. She took me to the playground and cleaned house and cooked delicious meals, and she was just part of the family. I knew nothing about Nazism before I went to school. I went to school, and even before the first day, my mother started to impress upon me that I had to do well in school. Now, why? Because there was a law called numerus clausus, whereby only 1% of a college class could be made up of Jews. If you weren't at the top of your class, it was impossible to get into a university. My mother had two more sisters who, had, long before I had been born, immigrated to the United States. Then they settled in Chicago. Her oldest sister was a physician, and I think Mom would have liked me to walk in her footsteps. I started to go to school, and first of all, I came home the first day, and I said, there's a funny-looking flag on a building in this street where I walked to school, and I knew what the Hungarian flag looked like, but this didn't look like it. Well, it was my first acquaintance with the swastika. This was the Hungarian Nazi, the Arrow Cross's headquarters, and thus the swastika hanging from their windows. I went to a Catholic school, and I kind of figured it out that one reason was probably the best education in the area, and the second, perhaps it was safer to send a Jewish child to a Catholic school than to an all-Jewish school. Because I went to a Catholic school, every morning we had a half an hour of the New Testament catechism, so I became well-versed in that. And we had a teacher come in to teach the Jewish kids our religion a couple of times a week. Obviously, there was no separation of church and state, as you know it in the United States. I felt no anti-Semitism in grammar school. We were all treated alike. However, after school, the Jewish kids went their own way. We had our own friends, and the Catholic kids went their own way, and never did we play together after school. The school system in Budapest is such that first you go to school for 4 years, and then you graduate. And then depending on your grade, well, if your grades are good, you can go on to a gymnasium, which is an 8-year college preparatory school. And if your grades are so-so, then you go to a polgári. And that's another 4 years of school whereby you learn a trade so you can make a living. Now I graduate from the grammar school, and I go, and there's a list posted on the door of the school. And I remember tears of joy rolling down my mother's face because, yes, I made it into the gymnasium. And once again, I went to an all-girls school. Now it was the Jewish girls' gymnasium. And life was still pretty good. By this time, often during the night, the air raid sirens went off, the Allies were bombing, and we grabbed some warm clothes, and I lived in a three-story apartment building, and we all went to the basement, and the building shook, and people were scared, and I think as a 10-year-old, I couldn't conceive the idea that a building could possibly be hit. But when the all-clear signal went off and we went back upstairs, that I could see flames shooting up in the sky and also smoke filled the air. And then I went back to bed, and my parents went back to bed. And in the morning, I got up, I went to school, and they went to work, and life went on like nothing had happened. This went on until March of 1944, when the Germans didn't fight their way across the border. They just marched their way across the border because Hungary and Germany were allies. And the Hungarian people, well, they accepted the Germans with open arms. Hungary was in a depression. They were promised more money. They were promised jobs. They were promised everything Hitler promised the Germans who fell behind him. And so most Hungarians who were not Jewish probably became Nazi supporters. There were a few who were not, who hit people, who saved lives, but most of them fell into the category of following the Nazi Party. Within a matter of 45 days or so, all the Jews from the outlying areas of Hungary were deported, mostly to Auschwitz. Of course, as soon as they came in, I had to start wearing a yellow star, just like every other Jew, and regardless of your age, no matter how young you were, yellow star, 10 centimeters in diameter, sewn on tightly enough that you couldn't slip a pencil between the stitches, so that you couldn't just grab it and tear it off. My parents must have heard of atrocities in the outlying areas, and they decided that Grandma and Grandpa, who lived about an hour train ride from Budapest, they decided that they would be better off in the big city because nothing like that could happen in the big city. And my father especially put all his hopes in President Roosevelt, and President Roosevelt was going to save the Jews of Budapest. The war was almost over by the time the Germans occupied Hungary. They occupied Hungary in March, and the following, where I lived, it was January, we were freed. So they had a lot of dirty work to do within a very short time, and they did it well. So now Grandma and Grandpa live with us, and I had to stop going to school. My father lost his business. And by June, we had to move out of our nice apartment and move into what they called a Jewish-designated or a Yellow Star building. They both mean the same thing. There was a big yellow star on the door, and they were trying to concentrate the Jews together in a closer proximity. And there went my nice, clean apartment, and we moved in with two ladies, and Grandma, Grandpa, Mom, and Dad, and I in one room, and an elderly woman, as I remember, and her middle-aged daughter in the other room. The worst thing as a child I remember about this apartment were the bed bugs. I never even heard of a bed bugs until then, and after the first night, I got up scratching and itching, and it was horrible. It was repeated every night. And these ladies figured out that, the bathtubs had to be filled with water all the time by law. Probably in case of bombing, there should be water available. And these two ladies during the night would go and shake their nighties into the bathtub. And I woke up to this blanket of floating bed bugs and a very unappetizing sight. My mom was never a cook. She was always a businesswoman. But Grandma was there, and grandmas are good cooks. So, as far as shopping was concerned, first of all, people had been out of work for several months by now, and money was running scarce. And even if you had the money, you were only allowed to go shopping late in the afternoon. And by that time, the shelves were pretty bare. But Grandma made do with whatever that she could find, and we weren't starving. And then my grandfather got sick, and so sick that we couldn't keep him at home. And we took him to a hospital. All of us went. And the hospital, the way I remember it was, like MASH or some of the old wartime movies you've seen with cots lined up one next to the other. And that's the last time I ever saw my grandfather, and whether he died of neglect, of hunger, of natural causes, or they killed him to this day, I don't know. But I still had Grandma and my parents, and I was very lucky. I was one of the very lucky ones because I was always with somebody who I knew would take care of me. Other children will turn away from their parents, and I can't even imagine the horror, the terror they must have felt before they were murdered. And they were murdered. So, we go on living in this apartment until a troop of Nazi officers march in, and a gunshot rings out into the air, and they order men, 18 to 45 working age men, to line up downstairs. Now we're in November 1944. The Budapest winters are cold, like your winters in Omaha and my winters in Chicago. And my dad put on his heavy coat and boots and a little knapsack. And one of the biggest lies the Germans told everybody was that they're taking these people to work. And that way the families didn't get quite as alarmed as if they knew where they were really going to the death camps. And my dad said goodbye to us, I'll see you soon, and off he went. A few days go by, and the same scenario takes place. Once again, the gunshot rings out, and now, this time, it's my mother. I can picture her like it was yesterday in her gray Persian lamb coat, standing in front of me, trying her best to put a smile on her face for my sake, and said, just like you would say to you if you had small children, just like you would say to them, I'm going away for a weekend, let's say, and stay with Grandma, and I'll see you soon. By this time, I'm 11, and that's the last time I ever saw my mother. I still had Grandma. I still wasn't alone. A few days go by and there's a knock at the door, and when there's a knock at the door, you jump to attention because it's probably the Nazis, and what do they want now? And to our surprise, it was my father. And he told the story that he was in a cattle car and not knowing where he was going, like nobody knew where they were going. And a couple of German officers needed directions to Budapest. And that was his lucky day because he spoke a fluent German. And that's what saved his life. He became their guide. They brought him back to Budapest, and they could have shot him, but they didn't. They let him go. So he comes home, and of course he looks for my mother, and we tell him the story, and immediately he says, I'm going to go after her. They're collecting the people at the brickyard, and I know where they're at, and well, they always collected the people at the brickyard because all the brickyards were located on the railroad and that facilitated the deportations. And I, as a little girl, tugged at him and said, Daddy, Daddy, don't leave me. Stay with me. Mommy's not here. Please stay with me. And even my grandma said to him, there's nothing you can do for her. There's no point in you going. So my daddy didn't go. And once again, there's a knock at the door, and now it's Julia, the lady who raised me, our housekeeper, or my nanny. And I don't know if this was prearranged between her and my parents, or she just took it upon herself and realized that it was time to try to do something for me. All I can tell you is that she saved my life by taking me home with her. Grandma threw a few articles of clothing in a brown paper bag. And with that, I got on the streetcar with her, and she explained to me, well, first of all, my Catholic school background now came in handy because I knew something about the New Testament, should anybody ask me. And then the one thing I didn't learn in Catholic school was the rosary, and she taught that to me very quickly because every child of Catholic descent should know the rosary. And then she told me that, well, we took off the yellow star, of course, and what we're going to tell the neighbors was that the Russians were already occupying Eastern Hungary, and my parents sent me ahead to my aunt to try to get me away from the Russian occupation. And I took her last name. Nobody ever asked me any questions. She also warned me that her neighbor was a big Nazi sympathizer. I had to be very careful what I said. It's a pretty heavy burden on an 11-year-old to know that you can't cry and say, I want to go home to my mom and dad, or even laugh out too loud because you can't do anything to bring any attention to yourself. Well, Julia had potatoes and beans and smoked meats in her house, so once again, we didn't starve. There were no deluxe dinners, but there was always something to eat. And then the bombings became so frequent. This is a 5-story apartment building. Everybody moves to the basement. And there's a stack of wood piled up probably for firewood. There's no heat in the basement. It's now December, and it's cold down there, and it's damp down there, and it's dark down there because there's no electricity. We live by candlelight. But above all, it was very stinky down there because there were no toilet facilities, and you have a couple hundred people down there. And a bucket is passed around, and the waste is thrown out, discarded during the dark of night. We all lay one next to the other on this make-believe beds. We took blankets and pillows to make it more comfortable. And in between bombings, Julia would run upstairs and grab some food and bring that down. And we lived like that for a couple of months. And by that time, our question became, what's going to kill us first, the Nazis or the bombs? Living through the war had become just out of the question already. And as we were most despondent, all of a sudden the bombing slowed down and then stopped, and then the machine gun fire abated, and news started traveling from building to building that there was guerrilla warfare in the streets, and the Russians were occupying Budapest, thereby freeing the Jews. Well, we waited until we were sure and that we didn't hear any explosions, and then we stuck our heads out the basement. Now, you're in the dark basement for a couple months, and now January, and there's snow on the ground, and the sun reflects off the snow. And, of course, you're blinded until your eyes adjust, but I could smell. As soon as they opened the door, I smelled, and the only way to explain the smell, that it was the smell of death. There were dead bodies all over the street. There were dead horses all over the street. People were running out with a carving knife to carve up the horses for a meal. But the war was over, and we were alive. Part of Julia's building was bombed out. The other staircase was still there, and we went upstairs. And, of course, there is no electricity. That's all bombed away, and there are no telephones. Don't forget, this is the 1940s, and everybody didn't have a cell phone, and even a regular phone. You had to be privileged to have very few people had a telephone in their apartments. We happened to have had one, but I think that was because my parents were in business, so they could call home. So all we could do was wait and hear what happened to the rest of the family. And one day I am playing in front of Julia's apartment, and I look up and there's my father. My father, a handsome 6-footer, very slimly built, and now he's skin and bones, and he doesn't look healthy, and I flew into his arms, and oh, he was one of the best things that could have happened to me. This sight of him was just, I was overwhelmed with emotion. Anyhow, he came into Julia's apartment and his story unfolded that he survived the war because he got papers from a Swedish diplomat called Raoul Wallenberg, who saved thousands of Budapest Jews by handing out papers. He bought a property in Budapest. And he said to the Germans, this is Swedish ground. I'm a Swedish diplomat, and you better not touch these people. And after the war was over, Sweden was supposedly going to take those people. How my father got the papers to get into one of these homes, I have absolutely no idea. Some papers are real, some papers were fake, but they worked. And as my father described that, there was very little food, and to quote him, there wasn't even enough room to stretch a leg. We were packed in so tightly. Well, slowly we moved back to our original apartment, and there was a family living there. They were decent people because the stuff we had left behind was still there. And now what happened to the rest of the family? And slowly life took on some normalcy. My father got his business back, and I started back to the Jewish gymnasium. And by this time, trainloads of deportees are returning from the various camps, and they're all sick and skin and bones. And they tell absolutely horrible stories. And we still don't know what happened to the rest of the family. Well, it appears that a couple days after Julia took me, the Budapest ghetto was formed. And the people from the Yellow Star houses were even more concentrated into the Budapest ghetto. There was a big shortage of food and, of course, a lack of sanitation, and people were dropping dead like flies. But this wasn't fast enough for the Hungarian Nazi parties. And they knew that the war was a matter of days or weeks, that it would come to an end, and they were going to kill as many Jews as possible. So they learned that they marched a group down to the shores of the Danube. They wired them together, and with one bullet, they could sink all of them to the bottom of the icy river. And that was the fate of my grandmother and my uncle and aunt, law-abiding Hungarian citizens. They were always Hungarian first and then Jews, who never did anything wrong in their lives. Their only sin was having been born Jewish. So now we knew that that part of the family wasn't coming back. And I was very, very close to my grandparents. I spent a lot of time, especially in the summertime, with them. And now we're waiting for my mother, and then my father comes home crying one evening from the store and sat me down and told me a lady came in who was in Bergen-Belsen with my mom, and then my mom died on Friday, January the 13th, 1945, in her arms of so-called natural causes, which probably meant typhus and starvation. And I, as a little girl, wasn't going to believe that my mommy's not coming home to me, so I walked the streets and I looked for her, and she wasn't coming home. My father contacted the American relatives, and way back around 1942, the immigration process for my parents and myself started, and we got so far that we had all our papers, and our luggage was already in Lisbon. So because we got our luggage back at that time, and that's how we got caught up in the Holocaust, but now the immigration process started all over again, and it was January 1947. And my dad and I got on a propeller plane and flew across the Atlantic. And we were met in New York by my mother's younger sister's husband. He was a CPA, and my aunt was a housewife of the 40s, and mother and housekeeper, etc. And my father told me all kinds of stories on this airplane about everybody so rich in America, and people don't wash clothes, they just throw it out when it gets dirty. And that I would be the princess, because my cousins were all boys. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. I was the princess in Europe, where I was the only child, but in America. Anyhow, My mother's oldest sister, as I told you before, was a physician, so was her husband. They heard my father coughing. He had tuberculosis. He was sent off to Winfield Sanitarium, and he was there for almost a year. They started me in school. I went in the third grade because of the language problem and kept moving up the ladder throughout the year. And within, well, 6 months after, one semester after I would have graduated, had I been born here, I knew enough English to graduate and make a little speech on the podium and go on to high school. And by that time, my father was well enough to be released from Winfield Sanitarium. And now I thought my daddy's coming home to me and is going to make a home for me. And I was so happy because I never really assimilated in this family that I lived with. And they told me they loved me, but you know, the family who loved me from the time I was born was gone. And why should I believe that they love me? They don't know me. They're strangers to me. And children think that those who died so that you did something wrong, that they perished. They just don't, I mean, I certainly didn't understand the realities of life. Anyhow, at this point, my dad says he wants to go back to Hungary. And that was the last blow for me. And my uncle, God bless him, and I kiss the ground every day in this United States, because he said to my father, I'll pay your way back if you insist on going back, but no way will I pay for the child to go back to that terrible country. And so at age 14, now I lost my father too, and I grew up with this family, and they did everything in their power to make me feel comfortable. But this was a family, an established family with two children, and I never felt like I fit. I always felt I was doing something wrong. And the princess now was asked to wash the dishes and throw out the garbage, just like I asked of my own children. But, you know, that's not what my daddy promised me. And as a teenager, I was a extremely, extremely lonely, and I had many girlfriends. My friends started dating. Oh, well, I started to overeat, and then they kept putting me on a diet, and that's the last thing I needed after I lost everybody that I loved. And they also told me that nobody would love me because I'm too fat. Well, so I truly believed that nobody would ever love me because everybody I loved had died or left me. And the boys I grew up with went off to college. I don't think my uncle figured on sending me to college. He wanted me to go to work in an office. That's about the last thing I wanted to do. I decided that if I went to nursing school, I could live away from home where I was so unhappy and learn something. And I even got a scholarship to Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago. Well, when I was a senior in high school, I met a young man who was 4 years older than I was, and he liked me. There was a boy who liked me. And he came more and more often to our house. And within 6 weeks, he professed his love for me. And he asked me to marry him. There go went my education. But it was so important to me at that time to be number one once again in somebody's life. And I truly loved him and he loved me. And I got an engagement ring for my 18th birthday, and following October we got married. The marriage brought about three children. It was probably some of the happiest times of my life when I had a loving husband and three little kids around me. And I can't go into detail because I don't have the time, but after 13 years of marriage, my husband got sick, and so sick that we couldn't live with him, and I got a divorce. I there was a high school graduate with nothing, no profession, and the Jewish Federation was kind enough to send me to school. They wanted to send me to 4 years of college, and I said, I don't have time, I have to make a living. So I went to business college, then that gave me enough to be able to go to work and make a living, and I was divorced, and I ended up raising my three children by myself, and those were some very, very difficult years. But they're all grown up, and they've given me four grandchildren, and I even have four great-grandchildren, and my youngest grandchild is going to graduate next year. She's the last one to finish grad school, and she's going to be a physical therapist. And I'm so very proud of all of them. And I've written my memoir, and they will be available as you leave if you're interested. They're called The Roll of the Dice, which is a line from my memoir that says that life was nothing more than a roll of the dice. And I thank you so much for being such a great audience, and I thank you for your interest in the Holocaust. And I speak here not because I enjoy recalling the past, but I know that I'm of the generation, the last generation, to be able to tell our stories. And I feel it is incumbent upon me that if people want to listen, I tell my story and see what happened, so that you can pass it on to your families and your children. And know it, don't let anybody ever deny it happened, because today you met somebody. My scars are not physical. My scars are emotional. And let me tell you, they're still there. I still have nightmares. I still hide my children in my dreams from the Nazis. So please, don't ever let anybody deny that the Holocaust happened. And now you're going to hear a very different version of another Hungarian survivor. And thank you very much.
Good job. Good job.
Good job. Good job. Good job.
Good job. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you all for caring.
Good evening. It's a hard act to follow. But my story, despite the fact that I was born and raised in Hungary, is totally different. I was born and raised in Hungary, lived in a very beautiful, loving, religious family, and my childhood was the same as any of our children in this country. Happy-go-lucky. Sometimes I tell the students I would do my homework, I wouldn't do my homework, and you know, I hung out with kids. All the fun things that a teenager should do. Matter of fact, I have a show and tell, and this is my photo at eighth grade graduation to prove it to you that I also had two eyes and two ears, and maybe the fashion was different then. But it's all just to substantiate the fact that I wasn't any different. So what happens when a happy-go-lucky child's life turns completely upside down? And how did it all happen? All of you are familiar with the onset of the rise of Hitler in 1933 in Germany. His major desire was to have a perfect race and space and slaves. And he pretty nearly accomplished his goal. So when he comes to power, he starts enacting all these desires, and he calls it the final solution, because his ultimate desire was to eliminate the Jewish race and many, many others, as Liz had mentioned earlier, who were not Jewish, but he did not like. So what is happening in Germany, they start creating anti-Jewish laws, which was called the Nuremberg Laws. And another thing that the Nazis have done during this era, there were two units of soldiers. There was one unit of soldier who was fighting on the fields. And then there was another unit of soldiers, which was called the Einsatzgruppe. These men were trained how to finalize the final solution. They were very well trained. So how did it all play out? In 1939, the Second World War breaks out, and they start occupying many of the Eastern European countries. So let's pick a country as large as Poland. Poland had a large population as well as a large Jewish population. So the regular fighting soldiers occupy the country. But the special unit's job is to go into the Jewish home, move the people out of their home into a ghetto, from a ghetto to a concentration camp, and thus the killing machine begins. Therefore, I call the Holocaust a premeditated, scientifically coordinated mass murder. Now I switched my thinking, my talk, into Hungary. I am living in Hungary, and as Agnes mentioned, Hungary is an ally of the Germans, so the German army stays out of Hungary for a period of time. But don't entertain the idea that our life was perfect. Certainly, a thousandfold better than our fellow Jews who were dying day after day by the thousands, because up to a point, we were still living in our own home. Up to a point, we were still going to school. Up to a point, we still had a job. But what the Hungarian government has done, they have adopted all the Nuremberg laws that was created in Germany. And now let me give you two or three of them. There were many, many, many more. So let's start with number one, the military. Until about 1940, all young men, regardless of their religious background, would enter the military service when it was time to do that. Matter of fact, my father was a dedicated soldier of the First World War. And he was a very proud Hungarian, serving his country and fighting for his country. And he would show us as children his medals, etc. So now in 1940, the government decides that the Jewish young man could no longer wear the country's uniform nor bear arms. However, he still had to enter the military compound, and they called it the Jewish labor force. That was their slogan, their name. So now, what has happened in my family, my brother, in about 1942, he was just about military age, and my parents had to outfit him with civilian clothing, just like when we send our children to overnight camp. And my brother leaves home, enters this military compound. The Jewish boys are put in a separate unit, and they are, in a sense, already imprisoned, because where the regular soldier is allowed to go on a break or pass, you know, visit friends or whatever the reason, those boys had to have a very, very valid reason to exit the compound. And the other tragedy was that these Jewish men were treated both physically and mentally the most brutal way by the military. Next, anti-Jewish law. The professor, the journalist, pharmacist, attorneys, first they were restricted from belonging to any of their professional organizations. But then, after a little while later, they got the pink slip. So from one day to the next, they were out of a job. Now you have to think differently here a little bit. There was no such a thing as a welfare system. So the Jewish communities had to pool their resources to support thousands and thousands of unemployed people and their families. And there were many, many, many laws that was just reducing us one by one by one. And this is the reason that I tell this story so explicitly, to make you understand that genocide does not happen from one minute to the next. It builds gradually. There are many signs that will indicate that things are going the wrong way. And it is your job, especially the children of the future, to protect our freedom and watch out for all these impending signs. So these anti-Jewish laws are continuing, reducing our livelihood, reducing our freedom. It just goes down all the way till you are reduced to lower level than an animal. So, as Agnes mentioned, March 19, 1944, the Nazis enter Hungary. They walk into Hungary. They are greeted and welcomed by their fellow allies. So like I mentioned earlier, the two units come in. Now the Einsatzgruppe unit, the ones who are dealing with the final solution, have another plus in their favor. Adolf Eichmann is the leader of this unit. And Adolf Eichmann was the most experienced Jew killer on this earth. He had ample practice for 10 or some years to negotiate all these steps. Therefore, in Hungary, in 51 days, they are able to take you out of your home and ship you to your death. So how does that work out? When the first order is to wear the yellow star, as Agnes explained that. So that is something already painful. Next, we are the Nazis are in for this limited time, maybe 10 days. We get an order. All the Jewish people will be incarcerated into a ghetto. And to the children, I always run a comparison. What we understand in the English language, a ghetto is where ethnic people decide to reside. But thank God they have total freedom to pick up and move somewhere else. But in real life, a ghetto is something totally different. So now the government decides that in a big city, a section will be allocated to become the ghetto. And all the people in the outlying areas within the county are collected by an umbrella group of the police called the gendarmes. These are the most brutal beings. I don't even give them the courtesy of human, because I fully understand that when a soldier has to obey his orders, but when that soldier obeys his orders 200% more than what is expected of him, that's sheer brutality. And these gendarmes practice that with full strength. So here how it plays out. The people in the outlying areas get the order that in 1 hour's time, they have to pack in a little overnight bag or a little brown bag or something, a 3-4 day supply provision, and then they have to line up on the street to be taken to the ghetto. Now, sometimes the distance could be 2 miles, 3 miles, whatever. On foot, these gendarmes are pushing the people, shoving them, cursing at them. And by the way, there is no such a luxury as a carpool or bus ride or train ride. On foot, the babies, old people, they have to march through different locations to arrive to the ghetto area. I happen to be born in the area where that will become the ghetto. So I lived in a house that my grandfather built maybe 40 years before that. It was a very comfortable home for 6 of us, my brother and I, my parents, and an aunt and uncle who lived with us. So now this gendarme comes with the group of people into the ghetto area and looks into my house and makes an executive decision and shoves in a bunch of people. You see, human courtesy have died. Because what if in the other section of town my grandma lived, or an aunt, or a relative? They didn't care. Just a group of people. So, ladies and gentlemen, my home became the residency for 40 people. You cannot fathom what crowded condition can be. These people are exhausted. They are in shock. And now, what my parents have done, once they knew that the people will be occupying our home, days before they moved the heavy pieces of furniture into the courtyard so that at least they can sit on the ground. Now comes me, the spoiled brat. Because I was the youngest child in the family, and I don't have to elaborate on it, I was spoiled. Which translates to, I had my own room and I had my own stuff. And this is where I learned to share. Because I had a closet full of clothes, etc., etc. And there were some young girls my age, and they had nothing. They had a little bag of stuff, so they could have that. So it was nice. Now, the people who came to live at my home was a tad luckier than the others in the ghetto, because my father was in the meat market business, and in Europe it was customary to smoke the meat so it does not require refrigeration at all. So we had a lot of smoked meat in our attic, so we could supplement the very meager rations that we were getting to eat. Once all the people were moved into the ghetto area, they were no longer out. It was fenced off, guarded, and we could no longer go to a doctor or a pharmacy or any of the very, very important things. We were locked in. I am going to tell you only two points to make you understand life in the ghetto. I call one the legal robbery and the other one the illegal robbery. Let's go with the illegal one. The Hungarian Nazi Party was largely comprised by a bunch of young, uneducated hoodlums. These people were paid off, riled up to hurt the Jew, rob the Jew, kill the Jew, and they were very obedient. So these punks would come into the ghetto. Now remember, this was an established area from years back. The homes were filled with valuables. They would walk into a house. Let's say they saw a painting or a carpet or a silver tray, any of value. Pick it up and walk out with it. Now, I'm not telling you this to tell you what they rob, because they rob everything from us. To make you understand that until this time, the police protected me as well as any other citizen if a robbery would occur. This time, the police looks the other way. On to the legal robbery. We are in the ghetto for a limited time, and the order comes from the government that we have to turn over all our cash, our radios, our jewelry, and other valuables. And we were too much afraid to even think of not obeying. So here again, I am not talking about the stuff. I want you to understand that the money they took from us paid the Hungarian railroad worker to ship us to our death. We are in the ghetto for a limited time, maybe 5-6 weeks, and the order comes. The ghetto will be evacuated, and we are going to be taken to another country because they need laborers. So now we think to ourselves, okay, remember, this is already the end of May, and the war has been going on for over 5 years, so we are hoping that the war will be over. We'll go and help wherever our labor is needed. We'll be over, we'll come home, life will continue. Unfortunately, it does not play out that way. And here came the classic lie of the 20th century. The families will stay together. Now think about it. We don't have any material things anymore. We have nothing. The only thing we have is our family. So what does that mean? We don't resist. We walk like the sheep to the gallows. So now the entire ghetto is evacuated, and on foot we march to the other end of town, to a brickyard. And we start wondering, why in heaven's name did they take us to the brickyard when there's absolutely nothing except bricks? There's no furniture, there's no roof over your head, there's no toiletries, nothing. Aha. But even that was scientifically figured out. Because on my 17th birthday, they put us into the boxcars. And I have a picture, which is, you can see at the Illinois Holocaust Museum, where they got the original boxcar. So, you see, they figured out the boxcars are adjacent to the railroad. The railroad track is adjacent to the brickyard, and that was a perfect location to get us out of there. So now, if you ever have a chance to see the interior of a boxcar, It's maybe from there to here, and about this wide. So you would figure maybe 30, 35 people could sit on the ground. But that didn't work out that way. They shoved in as many as 80 to 85 people. There was literally standing room only. You would just shift one way or the other way. In order to allow my parents to sit on the wooden floor, I stood shifting 1 inch this way or that way for 3 solid days. Once they slammed the door on us, in the corner were 2 buckets, one for toilet use, and one bucket was filled with water, except that water was never, ever refilled. So, ladies and gentlemen, besides emotional stress and physical pain, the absolute worst thing is thirst. You should never, nobody on this earth should experience what thirst really is, because they never refill those water container. And what happens after a while, you are so thirsty, you forget about your physical pain. You forget about where you are. The only thing you can concentrate on, if I could only have a slip of water. Your mouth is dry. Your lips are parched. And there are many issues within the boxcar. There are every personality present there. There is the quiet one. There is the one who is cursing, the one who is praying. There is everything. Crying. Any emotions that you have studied in Psychology 101, it was there. And the only one other thing I want to mention about the boxcar is that in the corner was a young woman with a baby on her bosom, but unfortunately, fortunately, the baby died on her bosom rather than suffering another way of dying. So now we have no idea where we're going. On the third day, the train stops, open the doors, and some strange-looking men in striped uniform come aboard, and we don't even understand what language they're speaking, but somehow or another, your senses understand the sign language. What they were trying to say, the little bit of belongings you brought from home, leave it in the boxcar, you'll get it later. Later never comes. It's collected by a different crew of people once we are emptied out of the train, and that unit sorts out the stuff, and if they find some valuables in there, it goes to the fatherland, etc. So now we exited the train. The men are directed to go in that direction, and that's the last time I see my dear father and any of the male relatives who came with us.
You've been listening to a program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. In honor of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which begins tomorrow evening at sundown, we've heard the first part of a presentation by 2 Holocaust survivors, both from Hungary, Agnes Schwartz and Magda Brown, both members of the Speakers Bureau of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. The conclusion will be heard next Monday, October 17th at 12 noon. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 29, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, and Kelly Keller, Director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.